as the echo of the wedding bells before the blowing rain dissolved into the bells of the lightning tolling for the rebel.
Did the occupation of Wall Street in 2011 and the movement that followed it fill you with hope for the future? Have you been wondering, what now? Tune in to A Deeper Look Thursday, April 24th at 9:30 a.m. Justin Weeds, founding member of the New York City General Assembly, and Micah White, former editor of Adbusters and founder of Occupy Wall Street, will join me, Linda Olson Osterlund, to talk about the launch of the After Party, what they hope will be the future for a populist movement in the United States. You'll hear about their manifesto and their plans for May 2nd. A mutual aid flash mob in Detroit, Michigan, and they want you to come along. That's this Thursday morning at 9:30 a.m. on A Deeper Look right here on KBOO.
Wednesdays for an afternoon of jazz. Hosts of Jazz Lives, A Jazz World, and Jazz in the Afternoon play the very best in jazz music. From the historical to the present, and jazz of all stripes, swinging, smoking, bluesy, funky, new and old, but all good. That's Wednesday afternoons from noon to 4 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And that's what's coming up at noon. However, it's 9:01 and coming right up on KBOO. Kathleen Stevenson's going to speak with Todd Miller. He's author of Border Patrol Nation, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Homeland Security, showing in stark relief how the entire country has become a militarized border zone. And we have a little music to take us into the interview. KBOO Portland.
There's a place where I've been told every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the border line. Then when it's time to take your turn, that you must learn, you could lose more than you ever hoped to find.
Good morning. Welcome to Political Perspectives. I'm Kathleen Stevenson, and my guest is Todd Miller, author of Border Patrol Nation, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Homeland Security. Welcome, Todd. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
For the past 15 years, Todd Miller has researched, written about, and worked on immigration and border issues for organizations such as Border Links, Witness for Peace, and NACLA. He did most of this work in Tucson, Arizona, and Oaxaca, Mexico, with stints in New York City sprinkled in. Between Tucson and the Buffalo-Niagara Falls region of New York State, where he grew up, he has spent the majority of his life close to the U.S. international boundary, south and north. His writings about the border have appeared in the New York Times, Tom Dispatch, Mother Jones, The Nation, Al Jazeera English, and Salon, among other places. Todd, how did you become interested in this issue and in the Border Patrol Nation that you write about?
Yes. Well, there's a long story and a short story. I'll tell you the medium story.
Okay.
I guess I could start out in the mid 1990s. I lived in Mexico for a year, and when I lived in Mexico, of course, one of the things you learned, you know, you learn Spanish, you learn about Mexico, the place. I learned a lot about Mexico, but I also learned probably one of the, actually I would consider one of my most important lessons was I learned to view my country from outside of its boundaries. And from that point on, I became really interested in border issues as far as the U.S.-Mexico border. I actually grew up on the northern border, and I'm assuming we'll get to that later in the interview. But set forth an interest and then almost a passion in these issues. And since about, I've been living on and off in Tucson, Arizona since the late 1990s. And since then, I've been in one way or another working on these issues, often in a journalistic way, but also I've worked with different organizations that look into border issues.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk about the map that's at the near the beginning of your book. You have a map of Border Patrol Nation. It's titled The Border Patrol 100 Mile Zone. Explain what that is and what it means.
So the 100 Mile Zone is that describes the jurisdiction that the U.S. Border Patrol has. It's the area where the U.S. Border Patrol can patrol. And this area is from the actual international boundary line, and that means the southern U.S.-Mexico border, which is 2,000 miles long, inward into the interior of the country at 100 miles. This also means the northern border, going from the state of Washington to the state of Maine, for 4,000 miles, and the jurisdiction goes from that border 100 miles to the south. And this also means the coasts. So down the Pacific coast, I believe maybe even Portland fits within the zone.
Right.
And the eastern seaboard as well. And within this is a jurisdiction with which Border Patrol can patrol. And it's quite extensive. You don't see Border Patrol in Portland right now. However, they could be in Portland in the future. You didn't see Border Patrol in Erie, Pennsylvania 10 years ago, but they are in Erie, Pennsylvania now. And what's also significant, if you look at the state of Florida, the whole state of Florida, if you look at the 100-mile zone, it's devoured by it. The state of Maine, the entire state of Maine fits in with this 100-mile zone. And what's significant about the 100-mile zone, too, is that Border Patrol works under the Department of Homeland Security. They have the ACLU describes it as this 100-mile zone as a constitution-free zone. Constitution-free zone because Border Patrol does work with extra constitutional powers that are above and beyond what local law enforcement normally has. Thus, your Fourth Amendment protections, the search and seizure protections, are not completely gone, but definitely altered in a very significant way. For example, I live right in the middle of the 100-mile zone where Border Patrol does operate in Tucson, Arizona, and it's difficult to travel anywhere south of where I live without going through a checkpoint. And the checkpoint, if an agent has any sort of quote-unquote reasonable suspicion, and their three major missions are immigration enforcement, so if they suspect I'm undocumented, drug interdiction, if they suspect I might be smuggling drugs, but also the number one mission is terrorism. And this is a post 9/11 shift, a significant one for the Border Patrol. This is their priority mission. So if they are to suspect for any reason I'm a national security threat, and they can pull me over, search my car, search everything I have, and they can do that within these 100-mile zones.
And you have no right to object or refuse?
You have rights, for example, if you go through a checkpoint, what normally happens, they'll ask you your citizenship. And if you're a U.S. citizen, you don't even have to, you don't have to carry documents with you. You can even say I don't. You know, you can even refuse to answer. There's if people were to look up on, you could Google this, I guess. But there's people going throughout, particularly the Southwest borderlands, and they're challenging checkpoints, and they're actually going into checkpoints and recording incidents where they are refusing to answer Border Patrol's questions. So what normally happens is about 10 to 15 minutes of tension. I think they could feasibly, with the suspicion, pull you over into secondary, and secondary is where they do the searches. So they, I believe they do have that power. But at the same time, you do have a constitutional right not to answer their questions.
But some people who wouldn't answer probably would elicit a different response than others.
If you don't answer, you're probably going to get pulled over in the secondary. You'll probably end up talking to a supervisor. You're probably going to have troubles.
I'm speaking with Todd Miller. He's the author of Border Patrol Nation. So, talking about this Border Patrol apparatus that's built up. You mentioned 9/11. Talk a little bit about the history of this whole movement, this whole Border Patrol project, and how it developed after 9/11.
Sure. When you look at the Border Patrol buildup, it's probably good to even look a little pre 9/11, because there are some significant operations. If you think about it, U.S. Border Patrol in 1993 was about 4,000 agents. It was formed in 1924 with about 1,000. So it grew from 1,000 agents in 1924 to 4,000 in 1994. In the early 1990s, around 1994, 1993, 1995, several operations went into place. The most famous that people mention is called Operation Gatekeeper. But that was based in San Diego. But the idea of these operations, much like Operation Gatekeeper in San Diego, Operation Safeguard in Arizona, Operation Hold the Line in El Paso, was to build up the border enforcement apparatus in urban areas, such as El Paso, such as Nogales, such as Douglas, Arizona, such as around San Diego, And so they concentrated agents, they hired more agents, concentrated them in these urban areas. That's when you started seeing walls. The first, you know, walls that were built on the border were built, replacing, they used to be chain link fences. These walls were started to build during these operations, concentrations of technology. And the idea was that the agents would sit side by side by side by side by side right on the borderline, making right behind the wall, right behind the cameras, right behind the, with motion sensors in front of them, and making it impossible for people to cross in traditional crossing areas, which were these urban areas. And thus, it was called a prevention by deterrence strategy. And thus, the idea was that people would be funneled into areas. If people were to cross, they would go to areas, they would evade this and go to areas that were just environmentally too isolated, too dangerous to cross. And this happened right along when the North American Free Trade Agreement was being passed, which in Mexico set off an exodus of immigration that the country has never seen before. So what happened was that you're seeing unprecedented numbers of immigration, and then they're hitting this prevention by deterrence, this Border Patrol buildup, and this is pre-9/11 still, and then funneling around that. And that's where we see a lot of, since those operations began in the 1990s, there have been 6,000 remains of people who have been found in the desert lands of the U.S.-Mexico border. It's because people if they cross that way, they must walk often many days. They're unable to carry enough water. A lot of people die of exposure. Oftentimes during the brutal heat of the Arizona summer. So that's the kind of strategy that was set in place pre-9/11. Post 9/11, that set the blueprint of what we're seeing now. The post 9/11 era, there were significant changes. One of the biggest ones was that Border Patrol is under Department of Justice, and it switched to Department of Homeland Security, and that's where the terrorism mission became the priority mission. The shift happened in 2003, and then you see this huge buildup starting around 2005. I mean, unprecedented buildup. They did a hiring surge, and they took on. It was by 2001, it was about 8,000 agents, and now it's 21,000 agents. But it's under Customs and Border Protection, which is 60,000 agents. Mm-hmm. Customs, I say that because Customs and Border Protection is not only your customs officials that you see in the ports of entry. They also have an Air and Marine Division, which means they have their own Air Force. They have their own Navy. They have Special Forces units. It 60,000 significant because that is a number that's double the size of Ecuador's army. So it's almost like a domestic army where Border Patrol is the front lines of that domestic army that has been growing and growing and growing in the post 9/11 era. And with that, there's all kinds of technology. Just the budgets have gone skyrocketed. One last thing before I let you, the budget for fiscal year 2012 for immigration and border enforcement was $18 billion. And that's more than all other federal law enforcement agencies combined. So that's more than the DEA, the FBI, the U.S. Marshals, all of them combined amounted to $14.4 billion. So if that tells you, that just that budget number alone should tell you the shift, the significant shift that's in the post-9/11 era that has happened.
Right. And this whole buildup and this whole influx of money into this area has literally changed towns, changed whole ways of operating in areas of the country. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Towns such as if you look at the Southwest, a town such as Nogales, which is in Arizona, which is south of where I live, they look almost completely deranged or from what they once were. They're completely altered. There used to be, they call Nogales, for example. It's a good example because it's known as Ambos Nogales, which means that the two Nogales, like meaning that these are a community that was a whole community, right? Nogales, Arizona, Nogales, Mexico, the same thing, the same community. What separated the community before all this happened was a chain link fence. I have a friend that talks about going through the hole in the chain link fence when he was growing up in Nogales in the 1970s and the Mexican side. And he always laughed because there was a kid on the other side of the hole that would charge a peso, you know, and that's what he'd at. So he'd go across and to play basketball with his friends, because his friends, his families, there's community ties, social ties, all kinds of ties, cross-border ties. So all the stuff that I just mentioned significantly altered that. There's just, I mean, nobody, I mean, the holes in the chain link fences are long gone. And now you have a large 18-foot, 20-foot in some places wall going through the two Nogales, Ambos Nogales, which if anyone's ever been there, it goes up and down the hills. It's quite an impressive sight. And behind that gigantic wall, you see camera posts. And behind the camera posts, you see the agents side by side by side by side. And in the town of Nogales, there's more agents patrolling the streets, and there's motion sensors everywhere, and there's and sometimes there's National Guard there, and the whole landscape is completely different than what it was once was.
And because of this influx of money, you write about the economic impact on these areas, and you visit one of your chapters is you visit a trade show that has to do with border enforcement products. Tell a little bit about that and why you wanted to write about that experience.
The trade show is really important. For the research in the book, I went to a lot of trade shows. One of the most important border one happens in Phoenix, Arizona, every year in March, and it's called the Border Security Expo. If you go back to the $18 billion budget number I just mentioned, that's just an example of how much money just in the United States is going into this. So when you go to the Border Security Expo, you see all kinds of government officials, like the highest officials from the Department of Homeland Security are there. This last year in March, it just happened 3 weeks ago, the Border Patrol Chief Mike Fisher was there. You know, but it's also, so there's government, but on the other side, there's all kinds of private industry. So just to give you a little example of what you see, if you go in, there's a conference in an expo hall, and the expo hall, if you go into it, it's in one of the, what are they called, the convention rooms with really high ceilings. So you go in there and you look up and you see banners of all kinds of different companies like, you know, big companies. Lockheed Martin has a banner, Raytheon,
Boeing,
and Boeing has been a big contract, has gotten some pretty big contracts with Customs and Border Protection in the past. And you'll look up and you'll see other things like surveillance balloons, on the ceilings with high powered cameras, and you can go and you can talk to the vendors, and then you'll talk to the vendors and they'll ask you questions like. Or you could they'll treat you like you're a buyer, even like I mean you have to have a name tag which for me says I'm a journalist, but they still treat me like I'm a buyer, or they have a pitch. So it's really interesting, you know, going to talk to the vendors, and the surveillance balloon, one of them, you know, I had an interesting conversation, and I had a notebook with me, and he said I can hone that camera in. The surveillance balloon is way over on the other side of the room. He said I could hone in on the writing on your notebook. And I said, no, there's no way you can do that. And the next thing I knew, he manipulated the camera, and there it was on the screen, on the monitor next to him, was the writing on my notebook. That's the kind of thing you see with a number of different vendors there. It's interesting to me because working on border issues for so long, it's hard to come across people who, almost everyone refers to the border when they're talking about the border situation, especially in the Southwest, as some sort of crisis. It's framed as a crisis. Like in Arizona deserts, there's lots of humanitarian aid organizations. They call it a humanitarian crisis. Over 2,500 remains in Arizona have been found since the 1990s, just in Arizona. But even Border Patrol, they'll talk about it as a daunting, dire situation. So going to the trade shows and hearing kind of that enthusiasm is startling, but it's this enthusiasm of any sort of innovation. We have the solutions to the problem. This aerostat will help, you know, that surveillance balloon will help. These cameras are going to help, you know. And what they're speaking to in reality, what I've discovered and what I discover in the book is they're speaking to what is many are calling a booming market, a market that is growing at least a 5% clip, a market that's worth billions of dollars. If you go global and you include Homeland Security emergency management market, which is primarily border security stuff, one market projection has it being a $544 billion market by the year 2018. That's a big market. So you have all kinds of companies, you know, looking at that market, and military contractors that, you know, repurposing their
And so we used to think of the military industrial complex. Now this is the Border Patrol, or how would you switch it into that? But it's an aspect of that.
Yeah, it's definitely a variation of the military-industrial complex, and that's kind of what I'm trying to look at in the book.
Yeah, and you mentioned the military issue, and one of the themes of the book is sort of the transition from U.S. military ventures outside the country, such as Afghanistan, to these kind of ventures within the country. Can you talk about how that crosses over?
Yeah, absolutely. One vendor at the trade show that I just mentioned, after explaining his technology. And they, and this was a smaller company from Tucson, actually, who were selling their company, their technology to the military. It was cameras, and he was talking about repurposing it for the border surveillance sort of mission. He told me, quote unquote, "We are bringing the battlefield to the border," and that really floored me when he said that. I mean, that's a kind of frank conversation you often get at these trade shows, and he said it in the most frank and direct and raw sort of way that I heard it, but I heard variations of that same theme. The idea is, with wars abroad at least ramping down somewhat, there's a need for companies that were supplying, you know, some of the technologies for these wars to find another market. And when they look at the border security market, which again, most people just think it's the southern U.S. border, and it actually is global. This global market, they're seeing something, that a new market which is growing and growing and growing, and thus you see this kind of transition from, that's why you have the Lockheed Martins, the Boeings, the Raytheons, you know, all of them present, very much present. And it gives a very militaristic feel to the trade shows. And if you look at the border now, you're seeing more and more of a militaristic feel to the borderlands.
And what is the use of drones like in the border these days?
Yeah, the drones are, there's a fleet of 10 drones, mainly Predator B drones. They're they're pretty big. They look like a gigantic mosquito. Mm-hmm. Most of them are on the U.S. southern border. Again, they can operate within that 100-mile jurisdiction zone that we were talking about.
So they could technically come around Portland, which is...
If they were operating here, I do not believe they are. they're not operating on the Pacific Coast, to my knowledge, as far as Border Patrol is concerned. But yes, if they were, they could come over Portland, and they are equipped with those high-powered cameras, that kind of technology that can zoom in, like I was talking about with my notebook. Some of them have... this is an interesting trend. Some of them have, or one of them at least, and they're trying, and possibly more, have this technology called Vader, and that's V-A-D-E-R. And it's always, they don't call it Skywalker, right? It's always Vader. And it's and this is kind of what they call man-hunting technology that they use in Afghanistan. And it was used in drones there to find roadside bombers. And now... One of the drones that patrols the southern border, which is about 7 or 8 that patrol the southern border, 2 that patrol the northern border, and I believe 1 in the Caribbean. This Vader technology is being used, and it's this man-hunting radar, but now it's being used to detect. It's attached to a drone, but it's used to detect border crossers. They're 10 now, but the plan is that it's going to double. They're going to double their fleet. I believe the plan is to get 24 drones functioning through Customs and Border Protection by 2020, I believe, around that year.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with Todd Miller. This is Political Perspectives. Todd Miller is the author of Border Patrol Nation: Dispatches from the Front Lines of Homeland Security. Another area that I found really interesting to read about in your book was another area you looked at. It was about young kids in the Southwest, at least, and maybe in other areas too, who were recruited and became sort of like Boy Scouts with the Border Patrol, or sort of...
Right,
Can you talk about that, like that, what that was, what that is?
Yeah, sure. It's actually... I dedicate a chapter to Border Patrol youth programs, and I look primarily at what you're referring to, which is their Explorers program. The Explorers program comes through the Boy Scouts of America, and it's a program for kids, 14 to 21-year-old, 21-year, mainly teenagers, officially 14 to 21-year-olds, who are looking at potential future career opportunities. One of the Explorers segments is a law enforcement one, which pre-9/11, there's a pre-9/11 and a post-9/11. Pre-9/11, it was a lot of community policing. You go in, you know, that sort of thing where you'd go with a police officer in your community. Post-9/11, it shifted, and that's when you see more Border Patrol. And with the Border Patrol and Customs and Border Protection, there's a high emphasis on the counterterrorism missions that these agencies have. So it's more of a homeland security bent. I looked at Explorer programs with the Border Patrol, primarily in El Paso. I went and actually spent a couple of days with them in El Paso. Was with them from morning to evening. So I saw, like when I got there in the morning, they were doing uniform inspections. So they were lined up almost kind of like you'd think in the military, like the kids, mainly, you know, probably about 14, 15, 16, 17-year-olds. That's about the age range of kids. The kid group that I was working, I went and saw, they were all of them were Latino, every single one of them. And when I got there in the morning, they were all lined up doing uniform inspections, which are pretty detailed. So there's, you know, and then they did a march around the building. So that's generally how they start their day. But the purpose of it is to what I've gotten is that there's a dual purpose. One is one that agents like different border. One of the details for Border Patrol agents is to work with the kids. So an agent might have 3 days that they spend on the borderline, but two of their days they have this detail. So they're an advisor to this group of kids. But one thing they do is try to identify potential recruits for an expanding, as we were discussing before, an agency that is expanding and has expanded exponentially since the early 1990s and has the potential to expand to much more even. And also, I think, and this might be the more powerful part of this, is when I was talking, for example, when I was talking to the group in El Paso, one of the agents who's an advisor, he said, "I we're talking about why this was important." He said, "Let me tell you about the El Paso Thanksgiving parade." I said, "All right, what about it?" He said, "Well, you know, when we just did it as Border Patrol, you know, we got a mixed reaction at best. You know, the people at the parade, they see us and they think, there's a Border Patrol, you know. But when we got these kids and they were a part of the parade and we had them doing a little move, you know, there was, you know, they did the parade. And when they did the parade, there was this wild applause and it was, you know, their families and their not only their families, their extended families, their cousins, their, you know, aunts, uncles, everyone, their friends, you know, and then he said to me, "This is the key to our relationship with the community."
Interesting, because I was going to ask you, these towns, whether they be in the southwest border area or the ones that are now becoming key places in the northern border, what is the relationship between the Border Patrol and the communities that they exist in such a dominant nature?
This is a good one. I mean, definitely these programs with kids, it's not only, there's other ones too. There's often Border Patrol goes into classrooms and they'll do anti-drug, they'll teach kids, they'll go in and do teachings of about their work on drug stuff and how kids shouldn't use drugs. There's a program called Shop with a Cop that Border Patrol's involved with, and they'll take kids to like Walmart and buy them shoes around Christmas time. So these programs with kids, there's quite a few of them. But there's also programs for adults. One huge one, and you see this north south, maybe in Portland one of these days too, it's called a Citizens Academy, and that's for adults. It's basically an Explorer program for adults. So adults can come in, and it generally lasts a couple months, and you go in once a week, and it's, you get a lot of hands-on, you know, like you get to shoot a gun, you'll get to play with the technology, you'll get to go to the checkpoints and see what kind of technology they have there. And the kids do this too, by the way. This is the explorer. You learn how to what they call field interviews, which is what other people might call interrogations. They learn how to do that. So it's this. That's the public relations seems to be built upon Border Patrol teaching the community about their work in one degree, whether it be children. Or telling the community about their work, whether it be children or adults, rather than what seems to be sorely lacking is the kind of conversation between community when community has critiques of the Border Patrol or critiques of abuses. This often gets set to the side or not even discussed at all.
Mm. Yeah. And it makes me think of something you related about, and I think this was in a northern area where there were, or maybe it was in the reservation that you write about, that's a very large reservation mm-hmm. in southern
yeah.
Arizona, but where the people who were working within it were key people, but they were not allowed to speak about their experiences. And I'm sorry, I'm forgetting the name of that group, but they were like Shadow Wolves, they were called.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so they were this sort of auxiliary yeah. organization, yeah. but they weren't allowed to speak for themselves, is
yeah.
what I got out of it.
Yeah, in my experience, and the Shadow Wolves, they're a very interesting group. They work on the Tono Otom Reservation, and that's in southern Arizona. What's really distinct about that reservation and actually Tono Otom land is that land traditionally, the original land, still their land, goes deep into Mexico. It goes as far as Phoenix into 200 miles to the south into Mexico. So when the actual border line was drawn there in 1853, it divided their land into two different sections. For years and years and years, Tono Otom would just cross. There was an actual boundary line, but people could cross back and forth, and for good reason. Like I was saying, like family ties. I mean, ceremonial. They were talking even deeper things. Ceremonial sites on that people crisscross. People on the side, of course, people in Mexico. That are Tono Otom will go to the hospital on the U.S. side or go to schools on the U.S. side. So this crisscrossing of the border is to them, the border doesn't even exist. So this is a good place to look at. In the post 9/11 era, pre 9/11, still there wasn't much border patrol there. Post 9/11, there perhaps is no more border patrol anywhere now than there. There's so many agents there. I just drove through the reservation a week or so ago, and it's exaggerated a little bit, but it seems like every other car you see is a Border Patrol agent, which is a green striped Homeland Security vehicle. One of the agencies that works there is an agency called the Shadow Wolves. The Shadow Wolves actually are not working with Border Patrol. They're actually working with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which is also a Homeland Security organization with an immigration enforcement mandate. But but generally ICE doesn't work on the border, but in this case they work with Shadow Wolves. And the unique thing about the Shadow Wolves is they're all Native American. It's a group that does border security stuff, primarily drug stuff, like drug interdiction stuff. They have a drug interdiction mission. And they only work on the Tono Otom Reservation, which is the size of Connecticut. If you look at a map of southern Arizona, you'll be able to see how big the Tono Otom Reservation is. It's the second largest reservation in the country, behind the Navajo Reservation. So the Shadow Wolves, they work in tandem with ICE, and I believe they probably work in tandem with the Border Patrol. But they're all Native American. They're not all Tono Otom. There's different indigenous groups that are represented. But when I went to interview them, and I described this in the book, I actually went to the ICE station there. They let me through the door, and I'm sitting across from the gentleman who's in charge of it, who's the head guy, the chief of the Shadow Wolves. And as we're sitting across from each other, he looks at me and he says, "Well, you know, I'm ready. I'm here. I'm ready and willing. I want to talk to you, but I first have to call the people in Phoenix and make sure this is okay." So he calls the people in Phoenix, and as he talks to them for about 2 minutes, and as his kind of face drops, I see his face drop across the table from me, and I think, "Oh, I know where this is going." And he then says, "Oh, she wants to talk to you." So the ICE person who's in charge, so any sort of public relations thing they have to do, they have to get approval from the public relations person at ICE. So the ICE person wants to talk to me. Mm-hmm. So the first thing she does is lecture me for a second. She says, "This is just not how we do things. You cannot just show up here and get an interview." And then she gets nice and she says, "Well, you know, I know, you know, they're very nice. They, you know, the Shadow Wolves are so nice. Of course they want to, but that's just not how the way we do things." And it was just this very interesting back and forth. And even so, the end of the story is, even though I was sitting right across the table from this guy, the interview was denied. So when I hung up the phone, and this actually is, she is right, you know, typical procedure is that you do go through public relations. So I did kind of skirt around official procedure. But when we hung up the phone, me and him just kind of stared at each other awkwardly. Yeah. And then I finally said, "Well, I better go, because I'm..." He seemed like he might be willing to answer a question or two, but I thought, you know, I don't want to get you in trouble. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's just best that I go.
But it's sort of a representative of how the system operates, that people within it either can't speak, or in one case, a man you write about who was a Border Patrol agent and well-respected for quite a long time, or for some period of time, ends up being fired because his loyalty is called into question, and he has a really sort of harrowing experience with his supervisors.
Yeah, that's I dedicated a chapter to this. He was an agent actually hired in the hiring surge, and the hiring surge happened between 2007 and 2009. He was actually just a guy working at Circuit City. He was a history major at his local college. He was born and grew up in El Paso, Texas. His cousin got a job at the Border Patrol, and he thought, "Well, you know, maybe that's what I should do." So he got hired at the Border Patrol, and he was really good. When I interviewed him, he said, "I had a knack for the paperwork." And this, it's kind of a funny thing to say, because you... most people don't, they'll say something else. "I have a knack for," but he had a knack for doing paperwork, and he liked it. And he actually, so much that he won Employee of the Month, which what he told, according to what he told me, was a kind of an achievement for a rookie officer to win Employee of the Month. But he had this experience where he was with a Border Patrol agent, and they were sitting in their exes, like normally, doing a shift, watching the borderline around Columbus, New Mexico, looking at the desert, and they started having what turned into be a heated conversation, and the conversation went on to some pretty significant issues. It started, according to my interviews with Brian Gonzalez, and that's the name of the agent, it started because his coworker said, "Why are Mexicans coming across and stealing our jobs?" So Brian Gonzalez responded saying, "Well, you know, I'm Mexican." So for some reason, this hit a nerve. I guess he'd heard it, you know, a lot of times, but this particular time it hit a nerve. And he said, "You know, I'm Mexican." So this whole thing went back and forth with them about his he was really referring to his Mexican heritage. His mom is from Chihuahua, Mexico. So they went back and forth about that. It got heated. Then they talked about the drug war, and Gonzalez said something about maybe if marijuana was legalized that there would be less violence. So long story short, and if you want to read the long story, it's very detailed in the book, an internal investigation happened. Gonzalez was brought to El Paso 2 months later. He had no idea. He'd totally forgotten about this conversation. He thought it was just two agents, you know, conversing during a shift like agents normally do. He's brought into El Paso, and all of a sudden there's this huge interrogation. The interrogation is they ask him things, and I have this in the book verbatim as well. They ask him things, are you a socialist? Are you more loyal to the Mexican government than the U.S. government? Do you have one? The one thing that really bothered him, so when I interviewed him, he said they asked me if I had intentions of overthrowing the U.S. government, and he when he told me that, it was as if I were the interrogator. He said he looked at, you know, he got his expression changed, and like he was hearing, reliving it again during the interview. But then a couple of months after that interrogation passed, and he was called into the office in Deming, New Mexico, and he was brought into the supervisor's office and told to remove his gun belt, and that means he was fired. The supervisor read the actual termination letter, and in the termination letter, it does explicitly mention his saying that his pride in his Mexican heritage and his talk about legalizing drugs. So his story is extraordinary, but it speaks to a lot of different complex issues, especially in the Border Patrol, especially if when you think about Latino or agents of Mexican heritage as well. There's this idea that there's about 50% Latino agents in the Border Patrol, but if you are a Latino agent, you can't. It's almost you have to separate what your heritage is from it creates this complex. It's looking at it in a very complex way. This idea that it doesn't matter if your mom's from Chihuahua, that part of you has to leave, has to go away. And now you are, this is what you are, and your identity is this, and this is important, that these clear, bright, enforced lines, almost like the borderline itself, are enforced even within your being.
You're listening to Todd Miller, author of Border Patrol Nation, Dispatches from the Frontlines of Homeland Security, here on Political Perspectives on KBOO. And I know, Todd, we mentioned at the beginning, we wanted to get into the border issues on the northern border. That's where you grew up and where you have, a personal interest related to growing up there. Where exactly did you grow up?
I grew up in Niagara Falls, New York.
So talk about the increase in that area and what you think is really important about what's happening on the northern border.
Yeah, the northern so I've been doing presentations around Portland, and one of the slides I show is in a PowerPoint is this picture of a green striped Border Patrol vehicle in the lot of a supermarket, and the Border Patrol agent is talking with a police officer. And I usually ask, where is this? And a lot of people say, people guess right too occasionally, but a lot of people say Texas or Arizona. And then I'll say, no, it's in SOTUS, New York. And SOTUS, New York is actually 15 miles outside of Rochester, New York. And if you locate Rochester, you think, whoa, Rochester, huh? There's no border crossings there, right? Well, actually, there's a lake, right? So it's on right underneath Lake Ontario. And the lake shore is now if you go to Rochester, you go to Erie, Pennsylvania, go to Cleveland, Ohio, you're seeing more and more Border Patrol agents. And this particular place, though, where the slide is in a county next to Rochester where 8,000 farm workers come every year, many undocumented, to work in the apple orchards. There's a Mott's apple sauce factory right by. And while the Rochester station did not exist before 2006, so this is it was put into place because of a ferry service that began from Toronto to Rochester that only lasted a year, but they kept the Border Patrol station. It started with 4 agents. Then soon thereafter, it expanded to 26. I think it's around 26. That rate of growth is important because that's the rate of growth that you're seeing throughout the northern border. Approximately 300 pre-9/11 to approximately 3,000 total post 9/11, which is significantly less still than what you see, the 18,000 or so that you see on the southern border. But the rate of growth is high. You go to the USA Patriot Act of 2001, they mandated, I think it was a 300% increase of agents and resources on the northern border. So of course you start the Rochester station, of course they're there, of course they're in the, you're seeing them in Rochester or Detroit or wherever in communities. The one thing they talk about in SOTUS, where that slide was a checkpoint that New York State Troopers would set up right in front of the laundromat, but they would put three state troopers but have a Border Patrol vehicle there. So if somebody was to go through the checkpoint, and they'd put it there on Sundays, and you know, the day that people would go, the farm workers would go do their laundry, and they'd have to go through the checkpoint to get to the laundromat if they're driving there. Mm-hmm. So if they were to suspect that somebody didn't have documents, there was a Border Patrol guy right there, and they'd send the person to them. So this is the kind of thing that you're hearing about on the U.S.-Canada border. You're hearing about kind of the very tightly woven immigration enforcement webs that, if you want to talk about these 100-mile zones, the classic story, and then I'll pause, is the Patrick Leahy. The Patrick Leahy story is incredible. It's Patrick Leahy, senior senator from Vermont, has license plates that say he's a senator from Vermont. He's traveling in upstate New York. He gets to a Border Patrol checkpoint. The Border Patrol agent asks him to get out of his car. He says, "Under whose authority are you asking me to do this?" And I'm paraphrasing. And the Border Patrol agent, according to Leahy's testimony, the Border Patrol agent points to his gun and says, "That's all the authority I need."
And did anything ever come of that encounter?
Nah, he just testified. He testified in Congress about it. He was actually not testifying about that specific incident. He was testifying about, you know, he was looking at the need for border security in general. Mm-hmm. So he brought up that incident, and that's how he brought it up. I have no idea if he pursued that with a particular agent. I imagine, now that you ask, I'm interested to know. I wonder if he as a senior senator, he would, but I'm not sure.
And the whole northern description that you gave brings up the point again of the economic impact and the economic involvement of this, because the towns that, or the cities that, a lot of that area is the Rust Belt. It's, you know, cities that have died and are now this influx of money. And then there's the issue that is one of the themes of the book that it comes through, is that because there's this whole apparatus, it needs to be fed with finding more people. Mm-hmm. Talk about that and how that is impacting this whole process.
For example, if you look, one thing that many people are talking about these days is deportations, right? If you look at the early 1980s, the United States is deporting, or is it officially called removing? That's how it's officially. That's the removals is official, but we'll call them deportations. 2,000 people per year. Now we're averaging, I believe a few days ago, there was a 2 millionth deportation under the Obama administration. We're averaging 400,000 approximately deportations per year. So that's a significant increase from the early 1980s. There's a congressional mandate that has 34,000 people have to be in detention centers at any given time. And that's the budget and resources for that that has been mandated by Congress. So in 250 immigration detention centers across the country, obviously not only in the South, Tacoma, right? There's a lot of talk about what's going on in Tacoma right now with hunger strikes. These are 250 immigration detention centers holding up to 34,000 people at any given time on civil charges, not criminal charges, civil charges, because so that they go to their deportation hearing. So these are people, this is the feeding aspect of it comes quite apparent when you think of who is running these detention centers. In many cases, they're private prison companies. The most prominent one is Correction Corporation of America, which is CCA. Geo Group is another one. They'll make an average through their contracts with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. They make an average of $124 per day per bed, as they call it. So for every one of the 34,000 people detained today, right now, detained for not criminal charges, detained just so they go to their deportation hearings, for all of them, they're making $120 whatever. So you can do the math to see how this fits into the whole idea of the industrial complex as well. That when we were talking about the surveillance equipment, all the surveillance equipment is for is then to create people that are arrested, right? You funnel the people into this ever expanding incarceration apparatus, which has been growing and growing and growing. And this needs to have 34,000 people, and the 400,000 people deported per year, and you have something. You have this whole system that kind of works in tandem, which is a gigantic machine at the end of the day.
Yeah, we only have a few minutes left, Todd, and I want to make sure that we talk about any kind of hopeful signs that you see in the area of resisting this or changing this. Are there any hopeful signs?
There are. It's hard. It's for some reason, this whole apparatus as a whole is probably not talked about as it could be. Mm-hmm. Like the immigration reform bills you see coming out, that Senate bill you saw come out in June had $46 billion going to border security. Mm-hmm. And that's a bipartisan bill. But any immigration reform bill you have a lot of money going into this. And so this sort of whole as a whole just needs to really be contemplated and talked about in a much more vivid way. And that's what I'm hoping. That's my hope, writing about this, and other people, of course, are writing about this as well and talking about this. And that's my hope, even talking about this, right here, right now, or mm-hmm. anywhere. But at the same time, there are some really, for those, there's some resistance happening that we have not seen actually before, and including stuff that parallels some of the stuff you'd see in civil rights movements in the past, mm-hmm. Such as blocking buses. And in Tucson, there was a guy who lied underneath a Border Patrol vehicle who was about to take away a father of four, and the four children were in the car, and he laid in front of the Border mm-hmm. Patrol vehicle and was actually pepper sprayed. And another incident, 100 people surrounded a Border Patrol vehicle that was about to take away two people in a big human chain. But from coast to coast now, you're seeing more and more actions. And these actions are you're seeing civil disobedience, but the civil disobedience raises awareness. And the awareness raises pressure. And the pressure, and that's where you see more pressure going on Congress people. You see more pressure. There's all kinds of pressure for immigration reform. But do we want immigration reform that is badly, badly needed? But do we want it with billions and billions of more dollars put towards an apparatus that will only incarcerate more people, mm-hmm. right? Is that the kind of immigration reform that we want? But that all of that's being put into question. So that there are, maybe glimmers of hope in that sense. And the other really important thing to mention is that this is very new. Mm-hmm. If you think about it, there's no border for most of the length of this country, of the history of this country, there's no border patrol. For most of the time of the border patrol is a very small agency. It's only been the last 20 years that it's grown into this gigantic monolith that you see now. It's not necessary. You don't have to. It can be. I mean, one thing.
We lived without it before.
We lived without it before. It does not need to be growing and growing and yeah. growing. And we don't need to be putting more and more money into it. We could stop at least the growth. And from there, maybe start, mm-hmm. making it smaller.
Okay. Todd Miller, I want to thank you very much. It's a fascinating book. Border Patrol Nation, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Homeland Security, published by City Lights. Thank you so much for coming
in. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
This is Kathleen Stevenson for Political Perspective. Stay tuned. Coming up is Flashpoints.
Just across the border line.
Thanks for tuning in to KBOO today. It's almost 10 o'clock. Time for Flashpoints. Among the stories today on the show, a new report from the United Nations about climate change. Also, a look at Chernobyl, 28 years after the nuclear reactor meltdown there. We're going to listen to a couple of announcements that will take us right into Flashpoints. Stay tuned at 11 for the Recovery Zone with host Stephanie Potter talking about improv theater used in conflict resolution.
I'm Don Merrill, and I've been talking to as many Oregon State judicial, legislative, and gubernatorial candidates for 2014 office as I can. And I've been talking to them all. Deep Blue, Progressive, Liberal, Democratic, Centrist, Independent, Republican, Conservative, Libertarian, Deep Red. Many of these candidates get ignored by the mainstream media, but they're not ignored here. Hear these interviews on my podcast at www.kboo.fm/between us. Listen to the people who want to lead you in 2014. Oregon State Judicial, Legislative, and Gubernatorial Candidate Interviews at my podcast, www.kboo.fm/between us.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Organizing and Winning for 21st Century Movements, Wednesday, May 7th, 7:15 p.m. at Portland State University. The speakers for this event will be Steve Early, author of Save Our Unions, Dispatches from a Movement in Distress, journalist Aaron Gupta, founder of The Independent and the Occupied Wall Street Journal, and Joanna Brenner, retired PSU faculty member who writes on feminist theory and politics. Again, that's Wednesday, May 7th at Portland State University's Smith Center, room 238 at 1825 Southwest Broadway in Portland. More information can be found at